Throughout history, from ancient times to the present, disasters have changed human life and experiences. And you may be surprised that it's not always bad. Sometimes destruction and tragedy teach us important lessons. We can see some of those lessons in the designs of cities and in other infrastructure that we take for granted. Our guest looked at past examples, hoping we can find some insight and invest in positive changes after the COVID-19 pandemic. You can join this conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think we've learned about different ways to live and organize our communities because of COVID? Are there specific changes you'd like your community to make in the coming months and years? Call 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Derek Thompson is a staff writer for The Atlantic. He wrote a piece called Get Ready for the Great Urban Comeback. Visionary responses to catastrophes have changed city life for the better. Derek, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
You give quite a few examples of disasters that have hit cities and then how they've used those to improve life going forward. So let's start with public health. That's the crisis we're currently living in. 19th century England was hit by one health disaster after another. Give us a sense of what people then were dealing with.
Yeah, so I think that we sometimes look back at the Industrial Revolution and we think, oh my God, that was the dawn of progress. It was the beginning of the kind of productivity growth that has yielded practically the entire modern world. But what it actually felt like to live in that hinge moment of history was pure pestilence. There was just constant epidemics, overflowing, overlapping, never-ending waves rushing into each other of influenza and typhoid and typhus, tuberculosis, cholera. I mean, it just never stopped. These cities were absolute horror shows. In fact, in the 1830s, in communities of 100,000 or more in England, life expectancy at birth fell to as low as 26 years old. And things got so bad that at one point, the government dispatched a young official named Edwin Chadwick. And Edwin Chadwick was a utilitarian. He was a dreamer. He had all sorts of interesting ideas for the future of mankind. And he undertook essentially this ethnography of urban England. He looked at how people lived and where their waste went and how cities were designed. And he said, you know, we've thought for decades, maybe centuries, that disease was a result of human failure. But when you actually study human life, you see that disease is a piece of architecture. It is something that we're not responsible for. It is socially created, and we need to socially create healthier cities so that people can live longer. And if you're a cold hard capitalist, produce more for your government and for your economy. And so he published this report, and this report in the 1830s really changed the entire face of progressive government. It invented the English public health department. It changed the way that countries across Western Europe thought about public health. And in many ways, public health historians told me when I talked to them about the legacy of Edwin Chadwick, they said just about every element of 21st century government that you consider progressive, from Medicare to Social Security, was in some way born from the Big Bang event of Chadwick's report. It was the beginning of a whole ethos of progressive thinking in the West. And it came from, as you said, these public health crises.
And it sounds like Chadwick paid attention to what was actually happening. He wasn't making assumptions, from some ivory tower. I mean, he was interviewing and talking to people who did the work every day, the people in factories. You also mentioned that they interviewed people like police officers trying to figure out what was actually happening in cities so that they could figure out how to improve it.
That's exactly right. And, the findings in this report just completely stunned the British government, and really stunned people across Europe who read it. I mean, just one statistic from it, because there are so many that I could pick from. Chadwick calculated that the number of people who died of poverty and disease in British cities in any given year of the 1830s, in any one year of that awful decade, was greater than the annual death total of every military conflict in the empire's history. So, as terrible as you knew war had been for the British, for the Spanish, for every global civilization at that point, poverty and disease, because of the Industrial Revolution, was worse. And it's because of this report and the way that the British government cleaned up its cities that people could actually enjoy the fruits of the Industrial Revolution, that it could make the world a better place to live. And that's why I think you can see this report of Edwin Chadwick as being akin to a big bang of progressive thinking, because from that moment really sprung forth modern liberal thinking about health and the working class.
Derek Thompson is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and he wrote a piece about how past disasters like floods and fires and disease changed the way that people built their communities. You can join this conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you wonder about how different communities have responded to major disasters? What might make living through this COVID-19 pandemic a little easier or more difficult based on how your community is built? You can share your story with us at 800-642-1234. Derek, let's stay in the 1830s, but let's move to New York City. You open your article with some terrible events that happened on a very cold night there in 1835. What happened?
Yeah. Yes, 1835, December 16th. By some reports, the temperature was 10 to 30 degrees below zero. And there was a terrible fire in Lower Manhattan that absolutely destroyed the city. And the reason the fire was so terrible is that when the firefighters came to pull water out of the wells and cisterns, there was no free-flowing water there. The rivers had completely frozen solid. And so what the city of Manhattan, what the city of New York realized is that they needed to do two things. They needed to find a way to get free-flowing water down to Lower Manhattan, even on cold days. And in addition, because they were also dealing with the cholera epidemic, they needed clean drinking water to be brought to residents. So what they did is they went upstate and they bought several acres of land near the Croton River in Westchester County. And they built a dam on that river and created a lake. And then they built a series of underground tunnels to carry that fresh water to every corner of New York City. This was an engineering triumph known as the Croton Aqueduct. It opened in 1842, and it completely changed the city. It gave New York its famous drinking water. It allowed the city's population to quadruple over the next four decades to more than 1 million people. And it really marked the beginning of New York becoming a fully modern metropolis. So sort of scoping out from this a bit, you know, I think the lesson for cities in America today and really around the world dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic is that, you know, New York didn't respond to the problem of the fire by just hiring more firefighters. They said, we need to deal with this crisis in a more systemic way. So they built a 40-mile aqueduct to bring water down into the city. I would like to see urban leaders, national leaders, rural leaders, leaders across the board, think about the problems America is facing in a more systemic way. This is not a crisis created just because we didn't close the border in time. It's not a crisis that's created just because, you know, one disease got out of China or whatever it originated. This is a crisis that is systemic, created by insufficient insurance, insufficient aid to our frontline healthcare workers, insufficient planning for pandemics. And it deserves a systemic response and systemic reform going forward so that we don't have a respiratory crisis every decade this century.
Well, to bring it back to Manhattan in the 1830s, I mean, you say that at least some of the needs of that community were already known, and then it took this disaster of such magnitude to bring about change. It's hard not to see the parallels to now.
Right. Yeah, it's very hard to see not see the parallels. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote the piece is that, you know, I was initially just really struck by how some people were thinking really broadly and creatively and systemically about how to address the problems of COVID-19. While, you know, I thought a lot of other leaders were being very narrow minded and they were just reacting to whatever the news was that previous day. The news would get better and they'd open the bars. The news would get worse, they'd close the bars. They were so narrow minded and so limited in their focus. And I would prefer that we all see this as an opportunity to change the way that we think about health, public health, individual health, and the design of our cities to make people healthier. And that is the charge that we take from this pandemic.
We're talking with Derek Thompson. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic, and we're talking about a recent piece that he wrote that discusses some visionary responses to different disasters that have changed cities for the better over hundreds of years. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What have you seen change in your community or in the country as a reaction to COVID-19? Have you seen improvements to infrastructure or how we live that you hope will stay in place? If you haven't, what would you like to see change? 800-642-1234. There's a line for you there, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. We continue this conversation here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking with Derek Thompson. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic, and we're discussing his recent piece called Get Ready for the Great Urban Comeback, Visionary Responses to Catastrophes That Have Changed City Life for the Better. And we're talking about what we can learn from centuries-old responses to terrible things that have happened in cities. And we're just discussing what we can learn right now. So, Derek, you were mentioning the COVID-19 crisis and writing it because you saw the parallels. Is there a concrete positive change that you have learned about or kind of been inspired by that you'd like to see come out of this?
Oh, yeah. I live in Washington, D.C. now. I was born in the Washington, D.C. area, and I lived in New York for 7 years in my 20s, nearly 30s. And one thing that always struck me about New York is that it seemed like a city that should be owned by pedestrians. And instead, in so many places, it was a city dominated by cars. And that seems to be changing. It seems to me that lots of cities across the country throughout the summer and into the autumn gave their street space back to the people, and they took it from the cars. In the last 50, 70 years, our cities, I think, have been over-designed to be accommodating to cars. And this isn't good for cities in several ways. It takes a lot of space, a lot of valuable space away from the public. And it also exposes people to, you know, a lot of long-term exposure to pollution from cars and trucks that are snaking through the city, which cause thousands of premature deaths in the U.S., along with respiratory conditions that are aggravated by the pollution that comes from cars. So I would love to see cities continue that trend into 2021, when hopefully we have everybody vaccinated from COVID-19. I would absolutely love to see city planners find ways to give more and more street space into, you know, outdoor restaurants, into parks, into just places where, you know, families could walk around and have picnics. Giving cities back to the people, I think, would be a wonderful and unexpected development from a pandemic.
Let's welcome a caller now. Rachel from Milwaukee wants to join the conversation. Hey, Rachel.
Hi. So I noticed when you were talking about addressing the bigger picture of pandemics, that you didn't mention the role that animal agriculture plays. And, you know, this is where these pandemics start from. So I think that that's something that we have to address. There's a lot of problems and harm that comes to humans from the way that we treat animals, you know, including antibiotic resistance and things like that.
Yeah, Rachel, thanks for bringing that up. You know, we appreciate it. So, Derek, Rachel's taking us out of the city and, you know, into places where we see widespread, you know, farming, ranching, raising of animals.
Yeah, it's a perfectly good point. I want to do something that journalists maybe don't always do on interviews like this and say, I honestly don't know enough to comment on animal agriculture and its role in this pandemic. Because I'm just not an expert in the intersection of urban planning and animal agriculture, and B, because I actually don't think we know exactly how this pandemic started. I'm not like a conspiracy theorist. I actually am just ambivalent. I don't think we have clear information about literally exactly who patient zero was in the pandemic. And so I don't want to overly predicate or overly, you know, blame any one particular policy for how it started. It started, it's here, it's a reality, we're dealing with it. And I'm focused mostly in my reporting on ways, and this is a local bias or a myopic bias, on ways that American cities can do more to plan against future pandemics and to be safer, healthier places in the future.
Yeah, certainly. Let's bring on Mike from Madison. Hi, Mike.
Good afternoon. Your guest is right on all this. We're so narrow-minded as a country. Prime example, lead in our water supply, Flint, Michigan. They've known it for a long time. They've done nothing. Many other cities have that problem. It's a huge problem that could be easily dealt with, but we refuse to deal with it, much like many things. We're talking about the cities. Great analogy is that, you know, if you climb a mountain and you get a little bit above a mile and a half high, there's no oxygen. So, prime example, if you lock yourself in your garage with a running car, you've got about a half hour, 45 minutes before you die. We have only a mile and a half of breathable oxygen on this entire planet, with a billion cars filling up that equivalent of the garage, which is our contained atmosphere. We know it's bad, but we're unwilling to do anything about it. The best we can do is what we're doing now, is talk about
and
it.
And Mike, I want to jump in here because I hear your point, and we only have about a minute left, and I want to make sure that Derek can respond to the idea of climate change as being another crisis that we have to deal with.
Absolutely. It's a huge crisis that we have to deal with. And it's a crisis that I think the most important problem that we have when it comes to climate change actually isn't technology, and it's not science. It's focus. We just don't focus on it nearly enough as a country, really nearly enough even as a planet. I mean, we're talking about a problem that we know is coming, a comet that is moving toward the U.S. at 10 miles an hour that's going to hit us. And we just don't really do that much about it at the federal level. We spend way too little money subsidizing solar and wind and geothermal energy. We spend practically no money subsidizing carbon removal plants, which might be the most important technology on the face of the planet. We just don't focus our attention at the federal level nearly enough on what many of us recognize to be the most important existential problem facing the planet, even beyond pandemics like COVID-19. So,
yeah, Derek, thank you so much for joining us. There's certainly more to talk about in the future. Derek Thompson is a staff writer for The Atlantic, and he joined us to talk about his piece, Get Ready for the Great Urban Comeback. It explores how people responded to catastrophes in the past and how the lessons they learned made modern life better.